I'm Derek Kennedy. You're listening to special content produced by And Another Thing on New England Public Media.
Ben Downing, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing. You were the first person to launch your candidacy for the governorship of Massachusetts way back at the beginning of this year. Tell us why you should be the governor.
I'm running for governor to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. And you do that by taking on the big challenges that we face on climate, on economic fairness, on racial justice and equity. And I think I'm uniquely positioned to do that. You know, first on climate, having led on climate issues in the state Senate for the 10 years that I was there, creating the offshore wind industry and the opportunity there, supporting solar energy storage and efficiency. But also, my own lived experience, having lived in and represented Western Massachusetts in the state Senate, but for the last 4 years working in the private sector, living in Eastern Mass, I've seen how the challenges that hold our state back impact different communities, and feel like that puts me in a position to build the coalitions that we need to take on those big challenges.
Ben, you know Western Mass well. That was your area. You're from Pittsfield. Now you're in Boston. What is the difference that you will make if you take office as governor?
I think first it starts with the understanding that the issues that face Massachusetts are actually similar across the 351 cities and towns. The solutions are going to look a little bit different. And I think it's knowing that a one-size-fits-all solution that's geared around Greater Boston isn't going to fit Springfield, isn't going to fit Pittsfield, certainly not going to fit the hill towns or the Pioneer Valley or the Berkshires, and knowing that we've got to be flexible in the solutions that we provide. So when we talk about infrastructure, yes, it's roads and bridges and trains and buses, but it's also broadband in those smaller communities just as much as it is childcare and support for the care economy as well. So I think that understanding that we can't have a one-size-fits-all solution, and the knowledge that we've got to be flexible to allow each community to develop their solutions within those broader goals, I think that's the unique perspective that I bring.
You were a state senator for 10 years, and you were elected very young. You were still in school when you were elected, correct?
Yeah.
What do you think you learned in that time that you can bring to the governor's mansion now?
So I think one of the things that I learned is, coming from Western Mass, representing the most rural district in an urban and growing more urban state, I learned how to build coalitions to be able to make progress on climate, on economic fairness, on issues that at the point that I took them on were not seen as being very popular, on transgender equal rights, for one example on that front. And I found a way to work with my colleagues to build a majority of support on those initiatives, knowing that coming from Western Mass, I was never going to have an issue that was the majority support the day I walked into the Senate. I had to find ways to listen to my colleagues, figure out where there was common ground, and then build off of that common ground to get the majority that we needed to make progress on those big issues. And, I think that unique perspective coming from Western Mass, enables me to be in a position to listen to folks first, and then to learn from that listening, and then build the coalition to make progress on those big issues.
You were one of the first ones to launch the efforts to be the next governor of Massachusetts. Since then, about four or five more people have entered the race, including minorities, women, and of color. How do you go up against diverse candidates?
It's acknowledging and being explicit about the fact that Massachusetts has a long way to go when it comes to diversity and equity in our leadership, in the public sector, in the private sector. And it's critically important that we support all efforts to broaden the representation within our leadership circles throughout the state. That's critically important, number one. Number two, in the campaign that we're building, I've made the commitment that we will build the most diverse campaign in this, or the most diverse campaign staff that will be in this race, and the most diverse administration in the history of Massachusetts. We've done that in the consulting team that we've built. We're going to do that in the campaign staff that we build over time. The other important thing, and I am not just saying this now, I would say check with folks who I worked with in Pittsfield in the 52 communities that I represented. You know, I'm someone who listens before I lead, who brings my own lived experiences to a race, but who always puts at the forefront of the work that I am doing and the work we will do in this campaign, lived experiences and the injustices that other folks have dealt with, unlike anything I ever will. And that is critically important to who I am as a leader, the empathy that I try to lead with, the urgency I try to lead with. And then it's on me to go out and make the case for the unique talents that I bring to the race. But you know, I'm excited to see a big, diverse, and open field in the Democratic primary, hopefully throughout the election. It's important that we all get out here and debate the big issues that are facing us.
If I can just follow up on that, Western Massachusetts has one of the fastest and highest growing rates of minorities, Latinx, in all of Massachusetts. How will you make sure that you focus on those growing needs?
You know, there is no simple or no sort of one tactic that gets you to that community. I think from my experience in the communities that I represented in the past, it starts by listening and knowing full well that Latinx populations are not a monolith, just like Western Mass is not a monolith, just like, you know, Black communities are not a monolith across the board, right? So it starts with listening first, understanding the different experiences that each of those populations have had in their different waves of immigration as they have come to the United States and to Massachusetts. And then it's being intentional about our outreach, being clear as we listen, and then having direct lines of accountability for the follow-up. And whether that is starting or supporting business startup efforts and small business creation and getting access to capital for entrepreneurs who need access to capital, or that's supporting workers in our service sector, making sure that work is work that is rewarded with a fair wage and with the dignity that it deserves. It's important to be there and listen and know that folks are all coming from a different place and not just loop them in or bunch them into one big category. So I think it's understanding that it's not just a monolith and that you've got to show up and listen to every one of those communities, not just in the campaign, but when you govern as well.
You chose not to run for a sixth term as senator back in 2016. You're mm-hmm. getting back into the game now. So you've kind of skipped an interesting time in U.S. politics. Why is now the time for you to get back in?
I will tell you when first just going when I got out, you know, my wife, Michaela, and I were sitting on our couch. You know, I was about to start a career in solar energy. Michaela was working in clean energy at that point. She was pregnant with our now 4-year-old son, Malcolm. And we sat there saying, like, I'm leaving public service and we're both going to work in climate and clean energy at a time where we're now going to have a president who denies the basic science behind climate change. It was terrifying for us. And I think we struggled with, like many folks did during the Trump years, how are we a part of the solution? And especially for me, how am I a part of the solution outside of the public realm? And, you know, the way I thought about that was to get involved with the Environmental League of Massachusetts, get involved in our local community here in East Boston. And the reason for now, right, is that, you know, I got to travel the last 4 years and help set up teams in the Midwest, the Mid-Atlantic, the West Coast, help see how, you know, a thriving clean tech company grows and what some of the challenges are there. And every time I was in another state, I would see, you know, them taking on an issue on higher education, on childcare, on any number of different issues with a sense of urgency, unlike anything I saw in Massachusetts. I would come back here and look up at where I used to work, and I would see a state with more by way of resources in wealth and talent in that innovative spirit, and yet we weren't tapping into it. And so those states that had less than us were doing more with it. And I couldn't sit on my hands at some point when I saw that, because I thought the missing ingredient was leadership from the corner office and leadership with a sense of urgency and empathy to meet the moment on the big challenges facing us.
Do I hear you saying that the pandemic played a big role as to why you're running now?
To be honest, it reaffirmed why I had decided to run. I think it's important for all of us to remember that while the pandemic may have you know, lifted the veneer off of this idea of Massachusetts exceptionalism, may have, you know, reminded us of the massive inequities that are in our society, they were all there before, and they were created through 30 to 40 years of leadership that hadn't taken on those issues with a sense of urgency that they needed. So, you know, if anything, for me, the pandemic confirmed the fact that our current way of doing things, managing the status quo, isn't good enough for the communities that I've lived in, that I've represented. It's not good enough for the issues that I've worked on for my entire career.
Staying with the pandemic for a moment, you have been very critical of the Baker-Polito administration's response. What would a hypothetical Governor Downing do in the face of a similar future crisis?
Yeah, praying that we don't want to have it in the first place, but getting beyond that, I think when you look at the governor's response, I think first during the early stages, during testing, I think the frustrating thing that I heard from communities, from school districts, was that there was a one-line way of communication. So you have folks who are on the ground trying to meet the needs in their community, who would be literally working with their neighbors. They would see a press conference from the governor, and they would see that what they were doing, they were told they needed to do something completely different, right? So there wasn't that open line of communication two ways that would have, I think, strengthened the response on the front end. Then when we had the vaccine rollout, you had the governor scrap a 20-year playbook that had been set up with local boards of health and with the Department of Public Health to support a vaccine rollout. I think that was a significant and a massive mistake by the Baker administration. We should have supported our local boards of health, our local providers, and not just completely deferred to the mass vaccination setup. I think that created a great deal of anxiety. I know it did just in trying to get my own mother an appointment. And that is with, you know, three kids who all have relatively flexible jobs where they could be on all of the websites. And we still had all sorts of hours and stress that went into that. We should have had central pre-registration from the beginning. It would have allowed us to prioritize equity. And we wouldn't be sort of chasing the inequities that we see in the system right now. So a Downing administration would have had central pre-registration, would have that, would partner with trusted local providers to get over some of the hesitancy that we've seen to date. And then would have prioritized equity from day one.
In your campaign videos, you mentioned that leaders have failed to build a community. Explain what you mean by that.
I think for the last 30 to 40 years, our leaders on Beacon Hill, leaders of both parties, have too often when times have gotten difficult, have sort of battened down the hatches, have turned inward, and have tried to just ride out the storm. From my perspective, that's not leadership at all, right? Leadership, especially in difficult times, opens the doors up wide, looks out at the community that it is charged with representing and serving, and says, what are the challenges, and let's all work together to try to solve them. I don't think our leaders on Beacon Hill have done that. I think too often we have had to push Beacon Hill to make progress on any number of different issues. Instead of our leaders saying, here are the challenges that face us, here is a clear plan for how we are going to attack those challenges, and then we will listen and engage with the public on the best way to do that, on feedback on those plans, and then build from there. And I've seen that in the communities that I've called home. I saw it in Pittsfield where, you know, growing up, GE was leaving and we were losing jobs, and the front page of the Boston Globe was talking about the Massachusetts miracle. Right? You know, there are very few communities that experienced the Massachusetts miracle. There are a lot more communities that dealt with what Pittsfield did, what Springfield did, what Holyoke and Fall River, New Bedford and Lawrence dealt with, right? That massive transition, and state government didn't step in to help those communities, and we're still paying the price for it, right? And we've seen it since as well. We saw it here in East Boston, where my neighbors on the one hand are told that they are essential workers, and then they come home from those essential jobs and they have to worry about getting evicted in the middle of a pandemic. That's what I mean in not creating a community, not seeing our connection to one another and the importance of investing in our neighbors, in our friends, and our family members to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts where when we look at any kid in Massachusetts, we should be able to honestly say to them, they will have the opportunity to make the most of their God-given talents. We can't say that today, and that is a failure. We can change that, and we ought to, and that's why I'm running.
Speaking with the subject of kids and preparing them for the future, you've talked a lot about wanting to eliminate poverty, eliminate child hunger. In your policies, you've talked about wanting to double the earned income tax credit, making universal school meals more sustainable. All of this sounds great, and talking about eliminating poverty is definitely something that gets people's ears perked up. Who's paying for this?
The wealthiest. Folks who have benefited the most from economic growth over the last 30 years, the last 40 years, folks who have benefited in their wages and wealth, just in the middle of this pandemic, right, who've seen their overall wealth grow, can afford to pay more to make the investments that will build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. And so whether that's through the Fair Share Amendment, which I support, or if the Fair Share Amendment doesn't move forward, I will have my own comprehensive tax reform plan that will be a part of the campaign's policy platform and proposal. What has come to define Massachusetts, if you look at it on the aggregate, you might say, well, Massachusetts is doing pretty well. But as you drill down, you see there are these massive inequities from one community to the next, from one region to the next. There are gender inequities, racial inequities, generational inequities. And the only way that we change that is to ask more from those who have benefited from the policy of the last three decades to make an investment so that we don't repeat that for another three generations beyond that. And so, yes, that's going to require an investment, and that will allow us to eliminate child poverty and hunger. That will allow us to have universal childcare. That will allow us to have debt-free higher education. Those should be the building blocks of a fairer, stronger Massachusetts, and one that creates prosperity in all 351 cities and towns, not in a few select ones.
If I'm a wealthier person in Massachusetts, you become governor, how high do my taxes rise?
So I think the first plan would be 4% tax on any dollar above the $1 million under the Fair Share Amendment. That would be the baseline that I would work off from. And we're currently developing a policy plan that would effectively step in if the Fair Share Amendment doesn't move forward. But I think that's the overall cost of the investments that we'd like to make.
This sounds like income redistribution. Do you call it income redistribution? Would you define yourself as perhaps a socialist?
So I think we've had income redistribution in Massachusetts for my entire lifetime. When the income taxes come down in Massachusetts, 25% of the benefit of that has flowed to the top 1% of earners. So while there's been global trends that have sent wages at the top end higher regardless, Massachusetts tax policy has made that worse. We've had redistribution for the last 30 years. It's just been redistribution that's made the wealthier wealthier. Right. So, yes, I do think we ought to ask more of the wealthiest to be able to make those investments to reduce poverty, to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. Labels are labels, call them what they are. But I think we need to be able to make those investments. I don't think that Massachusetts is going to be, you know, sustainable in the long term if we continue on the trends that we're on right now.
Let's talk about infrastructure. We know that Boston is working on a plan for their mass transit system. It seems that Western Mass continues to be left out of the conversations when it comes to building proper infrastructure, which we know is a trickle-down effect to the urban neighborhoods and people who need to get to work, need to get the vaccine shots, and the list goes on. How will you tackle that if you are elected governor of Massachusetts?
So first, Western Mass won't be left behind, just like Southeastern Mass won't be left behind, like the Cape won't be left behind, like the Merrimack Valley won't be left behind, right? And in particular on transportation, our status quo has convinced us that everyone else must be doing good, right? Because none of us, I think, can believe that we've ended up in this status quo where you either have very few options in Western Mass, or you have massive congestion and failing services in the eastern part of the state. So how do you break out of that? Part of it is enabled by the investments through the Fair Share Amendment, investments in expanding transit services and taking care of the existing infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure that we currently have. Another part of it is having more of a regional approach to these things. You know, we know that the transportation needs of the Berkshires, of the Pioneer Valley, of Central Mass, of the Cape, of the Merrimack Valley are all going to be different than Greater Boston. And yet, you know, we've had a one-size-fits-all solution in our state policy for too long. I want to empower regions to be able to plan for their transportation needs, to meet their transportation needs, and to then control their own transportation future. So the state handles what connects one region to the next, and then regions are able to better plan for their own transportation needs. And I think that's what's been missing in this debate, is empowering regions to control their futures. And I think that's one of the things that I worked on in the legislature. We were able to get it through the Senate, never through the House. It'll be a key priority and a part of my transportation plan as well.
I want to talk about your childcare plan. You recently came out and presented a plan for what looks like universal pre-K. Walk us through what that would look like. And again, the question, who pays for it?
We'll do the simple answer first. Again, that is one of the priorities, and that's why we rolled it out here early. One of the priorities for funding through the Fair Share Amendment, through our tax plan, right? So that will be there in the first part. The child care plan has several key provisions, and I want to be really clear. Sometimes in this campaign, we're going to have to come up with our own ideas. Sometimes there's great work that people have been doing on the ground already, right? And this is largely built off of the work of the Common Start Coalition, the Coalition for Social Justice, and the Mass Business Roundtable, because there's a lot of overlap there, right? So the idea would be that first we support the existing child care centers across the state, because they've been hammered throughout the pandemic. They were barely operating on a shoestring before it. And for, you know, effectively the existence of early education and care in Massachusetts and in this country, we've asked them to operate like businesses. And, you know, what that leads to is higher and higher costs, and the inability to pay their workers the wages they need, and limited amounts of seats. So we have multiple communities in Massachusetts where there are three kids for every one seat in a childcare center that they are trying to get to. Our second son, Eamon, is on a wait list right now at the East Boston Y, and we're trying to juggle our schedule and coverage to see when we can ultimately get him in there. So the idea would be first, support the centers, dedicated support for capacity building at the centers. The second is to cap childcare costs at 7% of income for anyone, anywhere in Massachusetts. And then finally, it's that childcare, early education, and care would be free for anyone making 50% of the state median wage or below. And again, the way you are able to make those investments is through the Fair Share Amendment. And you know, when you look at Massachusetts, 95% of residents of Massachusetts, childcare is too expensive for them based on the federal designation. The average cost of childcare in Massachusetts is higher than anywhere else in the country. It's quoted as being $21,000 a year on average. And everyone I talk to, and I know from our own experience, that seems low. That seems really low. I don't know how that's the average for cost based on what we've seen around here. And I think that's true across the state. And we can't talk about reopening the economy if people can't actually get to work. Their kids need care. These are the most important years of a kid's life, 0 to 5. And yet the state doesn't invest like it. So we talk about achievement gaps in school, but if we made the investment upfront in early education and care, then those achievement gaps are far smaller than we get there. So you invest to recognize the value of the work, a workforce that is predominantly women, 98% women early education and care providers, right? And then predominantly women of color, 40% are women of color, right? We can't have them living in poverty while they are doing this critical work. And you talk to every one of these centers, they're losing talented workers who want to do the work, who want to be early education providers, but can't afford to send their own kids to where they work. So that's the plan.
You know, you've been on the inside, so you know how hard it is to get things done. As passionate as you are about universal pre-K, transportation, the infrastructure, how realistic is it to get some of these things done?
So from being on the inside, what I know is that if we set our goals small, our gains are going to be small. And I don't think we're at a moment in Massachusetts where small gains are what we need. So yes, the policy agenda that I lay out is going to be ambitious, and it will be tough to do all of it. But I challenge folks who look at it to say, like, tell me what of this that you think we don't need. Tell me what you think you're fine with us saying we don't need it. Like I was in, you know, Cambridge last night and New Bedford the night before and Hanover the night before that. I'm going to be in Great Barrington and Springfield and Holyoke this weekend. And in every one of those last meetings I was in, childcare, housing, education, transportation, they all came up. And I know they're going to come up in every last one of those meetings that I have this weekend. So I think it's important that we lay out, here is the roadmap to get to a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. And then let's go out and have a debate about each one of those, knowing that there will be a back and forth and a healthy back and forth about that. But I don't think we can look at where we are right now and say that we are comfortable with that. I don't think we can look at where we are right now and say that we can legitimately look at every kid in Massachusetts and say, you'll have the opportunity to make the most of your God-given talents, right? Like that just fundamentally, I am not okay with that. I am convinced that we are better than that. I am convinced that we are capable of more than that. And that's why I'm in this race more than anything else, to try to change that culture that too often settles for better than what other states are doing, when we ought to be focused on with what we ought to be focused on is, what do our neighbors need? What do the residents of Massachusetts need to make the most of their skills and abilities?
As we've said, you took a break. You went into the private sector for the past several years. How does your family feel about you getting back into the politics game?
So Malcolm, my four-year-old, whenever I have to go do something for the campaign, he says, Dad's going to do government, which I get a kick out of that, and I love that. The toughest part of this is anytime I'm away from them. My wife, Michaela, is absolutely incredible, and she has stepped up in ways that I'll never be able to say thank you enough for. And any night that I am able to get back and tuck the boys in and help out in any way, that fills me up more than the best other achievement on a campaign trail. And as much as I don't want to give up that time with them, I also know when I drop off Mac at the East Boston Y and look at a room full of kids, I know all the opportunities Malcolm will have because he's hit the lottery in life. And I know that not every one of his classmates can say that. So we're going to make this sacrifice now that's going to keep me away from them for a little bit. And hopefully part of that sacrifice is ultimately being able to say to more of their classmates and more of their neighbors and their friends that Massachusetts is going to be a fairer place. It's going to be a place where you get the chance to make the most of what you have to offer. So it's a sacrifice, but it's nowhere near the sacrifice that a lot of folks across the state make every single day.
Your son is also going to grow up in a more diverse world, in a more diverse Massachusetts. If I can just pivot back to the economy, which you're saying that you're going on this tour in the next coming week. Some of the areas that you're going to visit were severely hit with economic losses during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. In Massachusetts, immigrants were particularly hit hard. I think it's over 76% of them have been out of work, unemployed since the pandemic. Western Massachusetts ranked right at the top in the state of economic losses. What is your message to them if you become governor as to how you'll help the economy rebound across the board for everyone, immigrants and non-immigrants?
So the message first is that you will be seen and you will be heard. Right? State government will not be something distant and separate. State government is going to be a partner in trying to rebuild our economies in Western Mass and Central Mass throughout the state. And state government's going to be a partner in trying to change the economic development policy of the last 30 years, the last 40 years, that's led to this uneven growth and development in Massachusetts where, we're fine with using public dollars to incentivize jobs in the seaport, the hottest part of the real estate market in Massachusetts and New England, when we ought to be using those scarce resources to support economies that need it in Springfield and Holyoke and Pittsfield and in North Adams, in Chicopee and Agawam, you name it, those places that have been manufacturing centers that need that support. The other part is, we're not just going to do, the have a statewide incentive and say it's a free for all, everyone come get it. We're going to be intentional about our economic development work. And this is actually in the anti-poverty plan where we say we're going to look at the communities that have the highest poverty rate, those that are a couple of neighborhoods, a couple of census tracts right next to one another. We're going to find the closest major employer nearby and say, where do you spend your resources outside of the region? How can we create opportunities for you to spend those resources right here? It's something actually that Cleveland has done through the Evergreen Cooperative that's empowered workers in those poorer communities to own a part of those companies and to be a part of supporting a major employer in their area. I think it's more intentional efforts like that that can address inequities, that can get economic opportunity to our new immigrant populations, that can help close the racial wealth and wage gap that we have here in Massachusetts that can start to close the gender wealth and wage gap that we have here. So you will be seen, you will be heard, and we will be a partner on the ground with you.
You've talked about how racial inequities, wealth inequities, all of this is very much tied in with climate change. You have a big climate change policy. And you've talked about how you've seen firsthand the short changes that the energy industry will take for short-term benefits to the detriment of the economy, the environment, people around them. Talk a little bit about that. What have you seen and how would you move to fix that?
So what we would do on the sort of first hand, right, is be really clear about our goals. We're going to have a goal for 100% clean electricity by 2030 and 100% clean energy. So getting it at buildings, at the gas and thermal infrastructure, getting it at cars and in the transportation sector by 2040. And then being explicit about saying that there will be a guarantee that 50% of the benefits of that transition go to environmental justice communities. New York has made a similar commitment at the 40% level. We make the commitment at 50% here in Massachusetts. And you know, the reason for that is, I think too often in Massachusetts, we've said, well, we've got this model of how we've always done things, right? That, you know, we're gonna have to always, there's gonna always have to be a gas utility. There's always gonna have to be, you know, gas stations for our cars. You know, the solutions are out there right now. It's not that we lack the solutions to climate change. What we lack is the leadership, the urgency, and the political will to implement those solutions. I believed that before I got into the private sector, but over the last 4 years, everything I saw has only made me actually more optimistic about our ability to solve climate change, as dire and scary as the news around climate can be. The solutions are at our fingertips, right? And so, you know, here in East Boston, there's an interesting debate going on about a substation that the utility says that they need for reliability. Now, they don't have to put out the information that says they actually need the substation. And we're effectively told in the community, well, take our word for it, we'll go from there. If that same project was happening in New York, they would have to put the data out to the public, and third-party providers, community organizations could come forward and say, well, have you thought about solar and battery storage? Have you thought about an energy efficiency program? Have you thought about all these other alternatives, and then propose those, and then ultimately have to make a decision among those? That's one of the ways that I would bring that in and start to change that business model, start to change that way of thinking, so that we aren't just saying we need another pipeline, we need another substation, but rather how can we use the solutions that will help us build a cleaner economy that will get to that 100% clean electricity, 100% clean energy goals. That's how you get there.
As you were talking about universal pre-K and making sure that kids have sustainable meals, another hefty task for the next governor would be to make sure that every child, every family has food on the table. Back to Western Mass, there's a big food insecurity that's happening right underneath our noses. How can you help fix that?
And just even before I get into my ideas on how to fix it, think about the fact that in Western Mass, we have, and just in Western Mass, never mind the state as a whole, but in Western Mass, you know, we have family farms that don't have a business model that allows them to stay open and in operation, even though they want to. And yet we have growing food insecurity, not 45 minutes, an hour away, in some cases, 15 minutes, half an hour away. How can we be comfortable with that status quo and say we're fine with where we are in that way, right? And so I think you can do a couple of different things. There's a state program called the Agricultural Preservation Restriction Program. So APR allows the state to support farms to keep them in operation when they otherwise might not have that business model. What we could say is that there is an additional level of support or a dedicated portion of the APR program specifically for farms that are gonna give part of their bounty to local food banks, local pantries that have made that commitment. And we could do the same in all of the sort of the startup infrastructure and grant programs that we do for new farmers as well. So dedicating a portion of state support to that industry to also reducing hunger and poverty. Another part of it is just, again, increasing the state's investment in the Mass Emergency Food Assistance Program, which supports the Western Mass Food Bank and its sister agencies across the state. And then finally, again, it's looking at those local anchor institutions, the bigger, healthier companies, and saying, where are you purchasing your food from? How can we get more of that food purchased locally to support those local farmers so that they can then be a part of addressing food insecurity in the surrounding areas? Almost every farmer who I've talked to within the first 10 to 15 minutes you talk to them will talk about hunger and food insecurity. They're going to talk about their commodity costs. They're going to talk about the pain of running a farm. But at some point, they get into the work, yeah, because it's what their family did, but also because, you know, they have this intrinsic, you know, sense of service in trying to connect people to make sure they have a meal on the table. So, you know, this is, as Congressman McGovern so ably says, you know, hunger is not a policy problem. Hunger is a political problem. And it is not a political problem on the scale that we couldn't solve it at the state level. We have the ability to, we ought to, and that's part of the anti-poverty plan I rolled out.
When you were senator, you were on one of the committees about tourism, arts, and culture, right?
Yes.
And this is something that's very important to Western Massachusetts. There's a big art scene. What would you do to bolster that economy and make sure that it can recover from the pandemic?
Yeah, so I think part of it is not thinking about the arts and culture, and even tourism in that sense, as something separate from economic development, right? Like the arts and the cultural organizations that in many ways are, you know, sort of what define our communities, what bring people to our communities, but also, you know, where we connect with the most. Like I know when I am in Pittsfield, my fondest memories are of growing up and walking to the Berkshire Museum in downtown Pittsfield. And I can tell you, you know, in painful detail, almost every exhibit there. So it's trying to wrap in the arts and tourism and cultural development to our broader economic development strategy. It's also, you know, trying to be a good spokesperson for the region and make sure that folks know and see the value in that region. But it's also trying to build out sort of the seasons for those regions as well. So you don't have to make every last dollar to support the organization in those couple of biggest months for you or your busier times of the year. And I think that comes with baseline support from the Mass Cultural Council to make sure that, you know, you're able to operate your mission moving forward.
People know who you are in Western Mass. People know who you are in Eastern Massachusetts. What don't people know about you? Besides, now we know that you know how to raise a lot of money as well. You've raised over $300,000 so far for your campaign, and I might be cutting you short here.
Yeah, so we're at 330, and I only know that number because it's like all but tattooed on my forehead every day by my staff and telling me that we've got to do more. And I would say without a single dime from a lobbyist or a PAC, holding ourselves to a higher standard in that regard. And I guess things that people might not know about me, I know what it is to get knocked down, right? I lost my dad and my brother both suddenly to heart disease, less than 10 years apart. And you know that changed the kind of person that I am and the leader that I strive to be. It deepened my empathy and it fueled my sense of urgency. So, you know, folks for weeks on end showed up at our house after my dad died and shared stories about how his service impacted their lives. And that touched me in a way that no event had before. And I think I probably wanted to give back to Pittsfield before that, but having had that community rally around us and hold us up, I wanted to fight for it as hard as it fought for us. And then, you know, when I lost my brother, Nate, I mean, Nate was my best friend. He was going to be my best man at the wedding that year. And, you know, it reminded me among so many other things that tomorrow's not guaranteed. And every time we say we will put something off, you know, another hour, another day, another week, another month, another year, there's a cost to that. And we might not see it immediately. But there's no guarantee that we get to get back at that. And we only get one chance to make the impact on this world that we want to make in our own way. And Nate reminds me of that every day.
Ben Downing, candidate for governor, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing.
Thanks so much. I'll appreciate it.
I'm Maya Schwader. Join the conversation. Email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. Or reach us across social platforms at Hello and Another.